An in-depth look at the engaging debate on US, China, and global issues. This is The Heat.
The United States Congress approves a massive foreign aid package. What are the implications for the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza? Hello, I'm Arnold Neidem, and this is The Heat. The U.S. Senate has approved a major $95 billion foreign aid package, with the bulk of it going to Ukraine and Israel. The move follows a similar vote in the House of Representatives last weekend. The package includes $61 billion in military aid for Ukraine to bolster it in its fight with Russia. New weapons could be on the way within days. Israel will also get $26 billion as it continues to battle Hamas. About $9 billion of that is marked for humanitarian needs, including Gaza. President Biden signed the aid package into law on Wednesday. But what sort of impact will all of this new military spending have in the two major crisis zones? To discuss this, joining me now in Washington, D.C. is Anton Fedyashin. He is a professor of history at American University. With us, too, is Khalil Jashan. He is the executive director of the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. Also joining the discussion is Brian Becker. He is executive director of the ANSA Coalition, an anti-war and anti-racism organization. And from Beijing, we're joined by Victor Gao. He is chair professor at Soochow University. Welcome to all of you. Anton Fedyashin, most of this U.S. aid package will go to Ukraine and others in the region to fight Russia. That's about $61 billion. How will Moscow view this, and will this actually, in effect, prolong the conflict between Russia and Ukraine?
Anand, it will definitely prolong the conflict. I have to also make sort of one, not correction, but remark here. According to Speaker Johnson, 80% of the money is actually not going directly to Ukraine, but is staying in the United States in the form of replenishment. And yes, $14 billion will go to Ukraine roughly in weapons and supplies. Let's look at it at the three levels very briefly. Tactically, the quick, rapid supply of weapons will help the Ukrainians slow down the Russian army, but it's going to come at a price for Ukraine, because for every Russian, there are 5, 10, 15 Ukrainians, Ukrainian soldiers dying on the battlefronts, and everyone's reporting about those figures now. On the strategic level, the second of three, I doubt that this money will make much of a difference, because the Russians are remorselessly moving forward, taking territory, and this time it sounds like they're not planning on giving it back or leaving it up to really discussion during the inevitable diplomatic settlement. In Washington, after the coverage of the aid, the passage of the aid, and then the inevitable signing by President Biden, we're going to be right back where we were about a week ago, which is the Russians moving ahead, massive casualties for the Ukrainians, and not an end in sight. The two D's that are anathema to everyone in Washington, debt and diplomacy, these problems will still be there. And then there's the third level, which is the strategic, world historical one, which is the general sort of world reset, geopolitical reset, which is not in the favor of the United States and the greater West. I don't think that these $61 billion for Ukraine, in addition to the other aid for Taiwan and Israel, are going to make much of a change. To change the course of history is going to take some very wise, strategic, far-reaching diplomacy, and there's unfortunately not many people who are thinking in those terms in Washington, D.C. right now.
Khalil Jashan, $26 billion will go to Israel, some of it for humanitarian purposes, we are told. The largest portion, though, will be for weapons for Israel. And in fact, a Palestinian spokesman said the money would, quote, translate into thousands of Palestinian casualties in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. So what impact will it have? And also, is it going to extend the conflict between Israel and Gaza?
Definitely. I think this is essentially not a package of foreign aid. It's a package of foreign war. for all practical purposes. As we just heard from Professor Fedyashin with regards to Ukraine, the same applies to Palestine. The amount is staggering. You're talking about $26 billion in support of Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is, by the way, about $2 or $3 billion more than Israel's total military budget annually. And of course, the argument by the administration is a small part of that. They identified $9 billion going for humanitarian assistance, but that was actually misrepresented as assistance to Gaza. It's not assistance to Gaza. It's USAID. Budget that will go to quite a few countries way beyond Gaza, and it is basically money to be put at the disposal of American agencies for which are involved in humanitarian work in different countries. So a small part of that will probably it remains to be seen how much will be spent in Gaza, but most of it will be spent basically on furthering the war and replenishing Israel's defense, missile defense system and other systems. It is true, as Anton mentioned earlier, that most of the money will be staying in the United States, 70 to 80%, but that's the nature of arms sales. Arms sales is basically a welfare system for the arms industry in this country. It does generate some jobs, there is no doubt about it. For every $1 billion we sell in arms in this country, it creates maybe about 8,000 jobs per $1 billion. So you're talking about maybe 5 million jobs in this country. About 1 million of us Americans are employed, actually, in the arms industry. But beyond that, it doesn't account for the bloody nature of this trade, how many people are getting killed, the damage being caused overseas, and the instability that comes back to haunt the U.S. in the future.
Right. Brian, there's been months of uncertainty in Washington over extending this aid to Ukraine. Most of that resistance has come from a group of Republicans in Congress. But now the bill has passed, as we've just seen. But I'm wondering, does this actually signal the end of these massive packages for Ukraine, especially if someone like Donald Trump gets into office in November?
Possibly, but I doubt it. I think that, as the other guests have mentioned, that this is essentially a form of subsidy for corporations in the United States that manufacture weapons. The United States is the largest arms merchant in the world. It's a big part of the current economy. It has a tremendous lobby. There's a reason that the F-35 is subcontracted out by the Pentagon in 46 of the 50 states, meaning that everyone has some sort of vested interest in maintaining the military-industrial complex. Of course, there is another element. The U.S. Infrastructure is falling apart. You know, the Francis Scott Key Bridge not far from Washington destroyed. The U.S. has allocated only $12.5 billion for the next 5 years to replace the bridges that need repair in the United States. There are 617,000 bridges, and 42% of them are more than 50 years old, needing repair as a consequence. So here we have the U.S. Lobby of the military-industrial complex sort of taking all of the money in society, using it for its own purposes, its own profits. And then the sales job, as Biden says, oh, this is going to make America safe. It's going to make America a leader again. Is the only way America can be a leader in the world is to sell military equipment, arms, missiles, bombs, and guns to the rest of the world? I mean, it's a really unpopular policy. Will Donald Trump change it? I don't know, but it's not just Republicans. Most Americans are not for this, but they don't have a say. Congress is almost unanimous, no matter what its divergence on other things, almost unanimous, not completely, but almost unanimous when it comes to genuflecting before the military-industrial complex and saying yes to every arms package.
Victor Garr, this massive $95 billion aid package also includes about $8 billion, which will go or is directed rather, to the Asia-Pacific region. I mean, could this have a negative impact on peace and security in that part of the world? And is this just another attempt by the United States to contain China?
Definitely. I think right now there is peace and stability in Asia and in the Asian, Indian Ocean and Pacific region as a whole. However, such massive military aid to countries and region in this particular part of the world is not going to help a greater peace and stability. It will actually disrupt the balance of power and eventually lead to greater instability. And eventually, it's not going to change the fundamentals on the ground. And eventually, it may actually haunt the U.S. government eventually. So I think Washington really need to exercise greater wisdom to try to promote diplomacy to solve the problems rather than selling weapons and provide more killing mechanisms so that the war in Ukraine will prolong, more lives will be lost, and eventually they cannot turn the tide. And then in Gaza, I think everyone is clear that in order to protect the legitimate rights of the Israeli people, you need to provide protection to the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. You cannot just treat the Palestinian people as a second-class people and drive them off from their land, etc. And I think the rest of the world is sickened to see all the violence committed against the Palestinian innocent people, civilians, especially women and children. And I think such massive amount of military aid to Israel is not going to solve the problem. It's actually making the whole situation even worse. Now, for the Asia-Pacific region, I just hope we can protect the current status of peace and stability, rather allowing the situation to deteriorate out of control and bring war and conflict and confrontation to this part of the world.
Heat is in proportion to the want of true knowledge. This is the Heat.
Anton, in response to the passage of this bill, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the U.S. aid will, quote, keep the war from expanding and also, quote, save thousands and thousands of lives. How do you respond to the Ukrainian argument that this will help them defend their sovereign country and also, as the president said, save thousands of lives?
Well, this is an argument that we've heard before in the form of the domino theory during the Vietnam War era in the 1960s and early 70s. It's a tried and true argument. The United States and the Ukrainians are certainly not the only ones to make it. The Romans made the same argument centuries ago, which is linking local issues that are very easily contained diplomatically, if there's political will, to regional or even global issues. So what Vladimir Zelensky is doing is he's very successfully appealing to a majority here in Washington, a political majority, which wants to continue the war in Ukraine in order to weaken Russia, although so far all the evidence points in the exact opposite direction, that the Russian army has learned to fight, that the Russian military industrial complex, which of course exists there also, is outproducing the West. Nevertheless, the argument here is, the narrative here is that the Russians are getting weaker on the field, although the evidence points again in the exact opposite direction. And the argument is that the Ukrainians are the buffer between Russia and the West. Never mind that if anyone bothers to look at a map, they can easily see that if Putin wanted to invade NATO, he would have just avoided the whole Ukrainian issue and gone straight into the Baltics, because Russia has border with NATO. But this is the issue with this postmodernist approach to diplomacy and politics, where everything is driven by narratives. Neither history nor geography nor the recent past really matters. And everything's handled like a political campaign in the United States. It's messaging, it's bumper sticker diplomacy in the case of Ukraine. It's quick fixes and political points, and then we go on with business as usual. Unfortunately for the Ukrainians, business as usual here in Washington is taking a very deadly and destructive manifestation.
Khalil, the kind of aid that we're seeing going to Israel, of course, it's nothing new. Israel is the biggest recipient of United States aid. But to what extent does the kind of aid that Israel gets from the United States enable it to continue its occupation in the West Bank, in Gaza, to continue doing what it's doing right now in Gaza? And, you know, this U.S. aid is given to Israel, while at the same time, the Biden administration calls for restraint, calls for Israel to address the humanitarian situation in Gaza at this time. I mean, we know the figures right now. It's killed, conservatively, 34,000 people. Some of the estimates are much higher. But does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense at all. Actually, again, it's not a new argument. After all, Israel has been, cumulatively speaking, the recipient of more than $150 billion dollars since its creation from the United States. A lot of it, if not most of it, has been used essentially to satisfy Israel's insatiable appetite for land, somebody else's land, in this case, Palestinian. And specifically in this war, I mean, this is a president who convinced most of us or advocated when he ran for office last time that he's going to be the president of diplomacy, a president of peace, the president for human rights. And now he is basically pushing or did push and succeed in passing the largest war budget we have seen in a long time. And the bulk of that is going to be for the pursuit of this war. The president is totally unconvinced that Israel has essentially achieved its objectives in Gaza. He is convinced that it needs more time, even though he's unhappy with the fact that it's getting too close to American elections. But he thinks it needs more time to avenge the events of October 7th. Now, the problem with that logic mm-hmm. is that the war has already cost Israel between $60 to $80 billion. So at what point do we stop? Is the next package going to be essentially all $95 billion to Israel to pay for the expense of this war so that we can support some government like Mr. Netanyahu that does not cooperate with the United States, does not acknowledge United States' interest in the region, mm-hmm. and is not necessarily an ally of this particular administration or this government. They seem to disagree on everything, yet mm-hmm. the president decides to go ahead and pursue that. So the other thing is the hypocrisy of this thing, the internal contradiction of this policy, as you hinted in your question. On the one hand, we're trying to prevent the spread of this war to other parts of the region. On the other hand, we practice this largesse, economic largesse and military largesse, in furnishing Israel with the tools it needs to proceed. And that's why we're getting these happy thank you notes, just like you mentioned with regards to Ukraine, not only from Netanyahu, but from every people, even to his right. Thanking the U.S. For its support in allowing it to basically continue this irrational, if you will, war of vengeance.
Brian, there was an analytical piece in the French newspaper Le Monde recently which argued that when it comes to Ukraine and Gaza, Joe Biden's foreign policies are, quote, mired in contradictions. I mean, they point out when elected, he promised to end America's forever wars, as it was known. He did pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. But now we see the United States directly involved again in Ukraine, again in Gaza. Why does the U.S. continue to get itself involved in these conflicts?
Well, I think in the case of Biden, there are perhaps two reasons. One is He has always been wedded to the very militaristic U.S. foreign policy. He was a big supporter of George W. Bush's war against Iraq, a war that was obviously based on lies. It wasn't an intelligence failure. It was just plain out lies. He's been a hawk. Biden is a hawk. At the same time, there's a second reason, which is no politician wants to take responsibility for a defeat. When Richard Nixon became president of the United States in 1969, the U.S. government and the Pentagon knew that the Vietnam War was never going to be won by the United States, that it was going to be defeated. It was a matter of how to leave Vietnam. But the war went on for four more years. 30,000 more Americans died, another million Vietnamese died, because Nixon didn't want to take responsibility for a defeat. They wanted to present it as peace with honor. And Biden knows, and the Pentagon knows, that the U.S. has lost the war, the proxy war against Russia, but none of the politicians want to take responsibility for the defeat, meaning, like, let's end this. Instead, they complain that Ukrainians are becoming, quote, casualty averse, which I can't imagine a more cynical explanation of what's wrong with Ukraine. They don't want more of their children to die. And so the U.S. is pumping weapons in and wanting Ukrainian moms and dads to send their kids to die. They're advancing, expanding the conscription age. Also, Joe Biden and the politicians don't take responsibility for obviously a defeat, a mistaken foreign policy, a war that could have been avoided through negotiations. Biden, Blinken, Sullivan, they pushed this war all the way. Yeah. They were the ones who said the Russian demands for national security were non-starters. They passively said Russia's getting ready to invade. They wanted this war, but they've been defeated. But now they don't want to take responsibility. The height of cynicism.
Victor Gao, there was an opinion piece recently in China Daily, which argued that the kind of U.S. aid that we're seeing right now, this bill that's just been passed, it belies the U.S. commitment to repairing bilateral relations with China. I mean, you know, we did see some positive momentum after the summit that took place in San Francisco last November. But from what we're seeing now, could all that be undermined?
Definitely, there is a risk. And I think what Washington is doing, not only as far as Ukrainian war is concerned, Gaza war is concerned, but also in the Asia-Pacific region, is a typical example of overreach, as described by Professor Paul Kennedy of Yale. Mm-hmm. U.S. is overreaching in Ukraine, in Gaza, and it is overreaching in Asia-Pacific. And eventually, there will be a point of no return. And I think Washington really need to care more about the fundamental interest of the American people rather than overreaching into overseas adventurism, for example, which eventually not only will not work, because eventually momentum on the ground will prove to be just the opposite, as the other that just now mentioned, and eventually it will cause the hollowing out of the United States going forward. That's the danger. That's what the American people should really care about, rather than encouraging the U.S. government to overreach into many directions in the world.
Anton, I want to get back to something that you talked about earlier on, and that's the Baltic states. I mean, Europeans are concerned that Russia may want to expand this conflict into other parts of Europe, into NATO member states like the Baltic states. They have already said several times that they feel threatened. In fact, they have been the ones urging more money for Ukraine. They see that as some kind of deterrent. But what do you believe are Russia's intentions?
Well, the Russians have shown no sign of any intentions to invade NATO. And again, if they had wanted to do so, they would have done it already. They have a border with NATO, which has now been extended, by the way, with Finland joining in. I don't see the Russians as making any plans to move on NATO. They seem to be wanting to prevent NATO's expansion right up to their borders with a string of CIA bases along it, which we now know existed from the famous New York Times article. So, yes, they are pursuing their fundamental, vital national security interests, which NATO seems to think they are in no right to possess, unlike NATO's members themselves. So until this fundamental disagreement about which countries have the right to have their vital national security interests and to defend them and which countries don't, until this question is settled, I think that these kinds of conflicts, unfortunately, will go on for a long time. They will simply erupt in different parts of the world.
Okay, and that is where we have to leave it. Thank you to all of you for being with us. That's it for this edition of The Heat. I'm Arnand Naidu in Washington, D.C.